Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Bassetta, assistant professor in communication and media at Lone University. Remember, you can follow the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web at socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. In this episode, we're going to be diving into some of the latest research around informal political talk online, which is essentially the everyday conversations that people have about politics in online spaces, whether that's a social media platform like Facebook, a mobile instant messaging service like WhatsApp, or the various online news websites that have comment sections where citizens can discuss politics. And there's a lot of interest from democratic theorists, but also key industry players, in terms of what is the democratic potential or significance of these informal online conversation spaces. If we look at industry, we might hear terms such as toxicity or Twitter trying to measure the healthiness of conversation. But what is toxicity and what is a healthy conversation? These type of terms don't really fly in academic research. So my guest today is Dr. Patricia Rossini. She is a Derby Fellow in the Department of Communication and Media at the University of Liverpool, and she has two studies that are recently published that deal directly with informal political talk online. The first is called Beyond Incivility: Understanding Patterns of Uncivil and Intolerant Discourse in Online Political Talk. That study is published in Communication Research, and we're going to spend most of the episode talking about that and disentangling the difference between incivility and intolerance in informal political talk. The second study we're going to discuss towards the end is called Dysfunctional Information Sharing on WhatsApp and Facebook: The Role of Political Talk, Cross-Cutting Exposure, and Social Corrections. That study is published in New Media and Society and is super interesting because it gives us one of the first glimpses into misinformation sharing on Facebook, but in particular WhatsApp, where there hasn't been so much academic research to date. So as ever, there will be links in the show notes to these two studies if you want to follow up and read more. But without further ado, let me turn it over to Dr. Patricia Rossini. Again, she is a Derby Fellow in the Department of Communication and Media at the University of Liverpool. Dr. Rossini, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So much of your research, including the two studies we're going to discuss today, focuses on informal political talk online. And I think many of our listeners are familiar with these kind of older democratic theory models like Habermas's theory of the public sphere, which was developed back in the 60s and long before social media. So to start out here, how do you understand informal political talk in your research? And how is your approach different from more traditional offline models of democratic theory?
That's a great question. I wouldn't say it's necessarily different. When we talk about Habermas, and that's a pet peeve of mine, but when we talk about Habermas and the public sphere, we're talking about very specific types of discussion. They're just not the everyday types of conversations that most people have in their everyday lives. But I was not the first to figure that out. Like, a lot of people have been investigating the role of these more informal political conversations that we have in settings like, you know, with friends and family, but also in the workplace, and et cetera, and how they can also promote, you know, what we call democratically desirable conversations. So moments that enable people to talk about things that concern, you know, their community or things that are problems in the country and et cetera, and to learn from one another, even if they are not, you know, public deliberation or what deliberation is meant to be, right? Like, I think sometimes we forget that deliberation is a very specific type of communication that is aimed at decision making. And most of us, when we talk about politics in our daily lives, we're not really making any decisions, right? So the rules of deliberation and even like the normative requirements of deliberation shouldn't necessarily apply. And part of the, like, why I said this is a pet peeve of mine, part of the problem that I had when I started researching online discussions is that, you know, a lot of people come in and say, let's see the online public sphere. And then they find out, whoa, it's not very deliberative, is it? And it's like, but why do we keep asking if these places are meeting these very high standards of public deliberation when deliberative scholars will show us that not even places that are meant to be deliberative, so let's say, you know, parliaments, are necessarily deliberative at all times, right? So I thought, It was a pretty narrow view of online discussions and one that just doesn't really, neither lives up to what online discussions are supposed to be, but also doesn't really acknowledge that we have been looking at informal conversations in our daily lives, workplace, family, and etc. for decades now. And they are not supposed to be public spheres. They're not supposed to be characterized by, you know, deliberative discourse.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think all of us can probably think of examples where we came across a post or comment on social media that was, let's say, not democratically desirable. And, you know, we often hear about Twitter being a cesspool or online conversations being toxic. And you take up this idea of toxicity in the first study I'd like to get into, which is called Beyond Incivility: Understanding Patterns of Uncivil and Intolerant Discourse in Online Political Talk. And in that study, you make a difference between uncivil discourse and intolerant discourse. So can you outline what those two concepts are for us and why you make a distinction between uncivil and intolerant discourse?
Yeah, so this is the core of the research that I was doing during my PhD, and these two concepts are still very much central to my work. Although now I have moved to more of a can we identify these patterns at scale type of research, and also to a perceptions type of research, so trying to think about the different elements of uncivil and intolerant discourse that can influence perceptions. But back to the concepts. To me, the simplest way to distinguish incivility from intolerance is to talk about incivility as tone and intolerance as substance of discourse. And I'll unpack what I mean. So incivility is a pretty highly disputed concept in research. And there is this deliberative, again, like let's go back to Habermas, this deliberative view that incivility should mean respect for others and their opinions. But most empirical research has actually focused on social norms and politeness norms, basically viewing incivility as a lack of politeness and as being characterized by certain words or a certain tone that could make it, as Kevin Coe, Kate Kensky, and Stephen Raines put it, kind of like unnecessarily disrespectful. So it's not really about what you're saying. It's about how you say it. And this is why it's super, super easy when you are explaining incivility, for instance, or even, you know, developing a code book to say, this is the civil version and this is the uncivil version. And basically, all you have to do is either add or remove a couple of words, right, that make something that was perfectly civil, uncivil. But with intolerance, on the other hand, this is less about how you're saying something and more about what is being said. Right. So in my work, I've been referring to this concept as discourse that attacks either individuals or groups in ways that violate moral respect, kind of like to use Axel Honneth's language. So, you know, back to Frankfurt. But this idea that it threatens democratic pluralism and principles of moral justice and equality. Right. Many big words there. What this means then in practical terms, or if I were to talk about like the subcategories of how we identify this when we're looking at discourse, is looking at things like signs of discrimination, violent threats, hate speech, also one of them, dehumanization, or even ideologically extremizing language as signals of political or moral intolerance. And that is because these types of discourse, they threaten either individuals or groups of their rights of being recognized as equal, sometimes their actual political rights, right? Like when you talk about some people shouldn't vote because they are on food stamps or etc. And I'm sorry if I have to give intolerant examples, like it is part of the concept, right? But sometimes even like just to challenge their presence in the public sphere. So challenge their rights to participate in discourse, challenge their right to voice their opinions and etc. These are all under the intolerant umbrella. And while these two things can be together, right? Like you can be uncivil and intolerant. What is really problematic is that intolerance can come disguised in very civil words. And when it happens, right, it's almost hard to recognize it because they're saying it's so nice, but still intolerant.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting distinction between tone and substance because, as you just said, they often go together, uncivil and intolerant discourses, but they can be different, right? You can say something intolerant in a way that is more or less polite, but you can also say something tolerant in a way that is uncivil. And you argue that uncivil discourse isn't necessarily a bad thing in online discussions. Why might that be?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's for a set of reasons. Incivility can be used to offend other people, right? Like you can be calling people names and that can come across as offensive, but that's not necessarily so. And you're also not necessarily calling them offensive names to their faces. We have some research that suggests that people negotiate rules of civility in different contexts, right? So there are words, let's say, you know, profanities or vulgar words that are perfectly normal for you to say among your friends, but you didn't use them, you know, talking to your boss and things like that, right? So incivility is kind of like negotiated across different contexts, and also your perception and the group perception of what is acceptable and what not. We also have some research in this point. I'll shout out to Emily Sidner's book on incivility and conflict orientation, looking at the relationship between these two things, where she finds that for some people, particularly for people who are more conflict oriented, people who like discussions, people who like disagreement, incivility is actually entertaining. Incivility can actually motivate people to participate more, right? So it's not necessarily a bad thing. And it does seem to have some positive outcomes, like, you know, firing up people to participate and et cetera. And part of why I got into studying incivility and thinking about, you know, why do we all have to say incivility makes the internet bad and therefore all conversations that happen online are just, you know, bad and not useful and serve no purpose, was that it's not like that in real life, right? Like, I am sure I have, and I don't know about you, but like, I have pretty uncivil conversations where we use a bunch of curse words and profanities, you know, to talk about something. Sometimes it's just because we're really excited, so we want to say that this thing is effing great, right? Or this thing is effing awesome. Like, it just can be used for so many different things. And I think this narrow view that incivility is just to insult and just to attack and just to make online environments toxic is pretty narrow, especially when we have so much research on perceptions of incivility that suggests that what most people see as uncivil doesn't necessarily correlate with what us researchers tend to measure as uncivil in the first place, right? So it is pretty broad concept, I would say. It's very common to say incivility is on the eye of the beholder, right? Because it is about this negotiation of conversation norms. And of course that the internet is conducive to, you know, more uncivil discourse. Like, why might that be? Well, first, we're talking to people we don't necessarily know, right? Although this is changing now that we talk to people on social media and we might know them. It's kind of comes with the territory to talk about things in kind of uncivil ways. Another thing that incivility tends to do, and work by Diana Mutz has suggested that, is it grabs your attention, right? It makes arguments more recognizable and also remembered, right? So there are a bunch of strategic reasons why people might use uncivil discourse when they're talking about politics. And I think that saying that just because that conversation is uncivil, it is inherently bad, it's just a pretty narrow view of its rhetorical functions, I would say.
Definitely. And, you know, I think you're doing a great job giving examples that are still in the civil territory, trying to keep the podcast rated PG. But I understand how it could be. Yeah, we're trying to describe examples. It's hard not to lean into these profanities because they do attract attention from people. But to study incivility and intolerant discourses online, you examined discussions in Brazil using news stories that were posted on Facebook and following them to a news aggregator or a news portal called Portal UOL. So can you describe for us what Portal UOL is and what are some of the key differences between Portal UOL and Facebook that might affect levels of uncivil and intolerant discourses online?
Yes, absolutely. So part of the idea, then again, thinking about what people were doing at the time and what I wanted to do for my dissertation was that a lot of studies were basically single source studies, right? So you look at comments from the New York Times or comments from The Guardian and et cetera. And I picked this news portal in Brazil that's very similar to like the former AOL in the US. And I don't know what else could be compared to. But basically this news website that has partnerships with several local, regional, and national news pages, so actual news media organizations, and they share information not only from their own newsroom, because now they have one, but also from all these places. So the design was basically looking at what this portal would post on their Facebook page, so like all the news that they were posting for a period of 6 months, and then following those stories to their own sources. So in the end, in my sample, I was comparing comments that were left on any given story on Facebook to the comments left in their own source. So the source might have been, for instance, you know, the New York Times, or it's a regional newspaper like the Liverpool Echo, or etc. So we had a lot of variety there. And the reason for that was that these different outlets could have, you know, just different stuff going on. So when we look at, you know, New York Times commenters, there might be something that characterizes people who go to the New York Times and comments. But when you have a really broad set of sources, then I think this individual differences between news websites would make less of a difference. If I remember correctly, in my sample, there were two websites that are a bit more prominent. One was Portal Wall itself, so like the news stories that they posted from their own newsroom, but also Folha de São Paulo, which is one of the main newspapers in Brazil, like national newspapers. These were the two main sources, but there are also some celebrity portals, like entertainment websites, because some stories were about, you know, some celebrities that were either suffering discrimination or, you know, coming out as gay. And those stories were also there. So like this, all these kinds of stuff. And the idea was that all these news sources, they would share some of the characteristics that we typically see news websites. So you have comments that can be left with a somewhat anonymous nickname, right? Even though most sites nowadays have registration, so you can't just go there and comment unregistered, you still have some freedom, put it that way, to just, you know, hide yourself behind a nickname. And the reason to do that, again, like all the research on incivility had suggested that anonymity was the culprit, right? Like we are so uncivil online because we can be anonymous. So what I wanted to do was compare a set of anonymous spaces, so like these news sources, to Facebook, where people have their real names, their pictures, their dogs, their friends, and see whether there would be differences there. I expected to see a lot of differences, mainly because, you know, all research had been telling us until then, you know, for the past decade or so, that what makes the internet so uncivil is the fact that we can be anonymous, that we talk to people we don't know, and that we basically don't really feel connected or accountable for what we say because of all this anonymity and this lack of social cues. So I thought that there would be a big, big difference between these two platforms, which was not really what I found in the end.
Yeah, but before we get there, I want to ask you about some other variables you included, because I think they're important. But just to be clear for the listeners and to recap, because I think this is a really cool research design, is that you followed what this portal that takes all different types of news posted on Facebook and then examined the Facebook comments versus the comments on the original news site that the portal had linked to.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. So yeah, as I said, before getting into the findings, you weren't just measuring these levels of incivility and intolerance. You also examined, I think, two key variables. One is disagreement, and the other is justified opinion expression and how they relate to incivility and intolerance. So can you outline why you included these two variables, disagreement and justified opinion expression, and how you thought they might relate to uncivil and intolerant discourses?
Yeah, that's a great question. The justified opinion expression is, you know, basically deliberation, right? Like thinking about deliberation and deliberative scholars and how what you want is not only that people express their opinions, but also that people express their opinions in ways that others can understand, right? So I don't say I like fruit and that's it, but I say I like fruit because it's, you know, refreshing in the morning or whatever. And the rationale behind that is just that if you express your opinions and justify them, then others around you can understand why you think what you think, right? And that has important outcomes in terms of how they can engage in conversation with you, especially in the context of disagreement. So these two variables are very much linked to my background in deliberative theory. So it's not that I don't like Habermas and the public sphere. It's just that I just don't think that we should be looking for the public sphere everywhere. But the underlying idea there was to try to see if both incivility and intolerant discourse were in some way related to these features that are typically considered to characterize what we call like democratically relevant political talk or democratically desirable political talk. So justification, I just mentioned, is mainly because you want people to be able to understand your arguments so that they can engage with them. And disagreement is important because you want people to be exposed to a variety of views and viewpoints. And if those viewpoints are expressed, you know, with justified opinions, then we can all understand each other a little better. So that was the main goal. And part of the reason why I thought they would be interesting to look at in relation to incivility and intolerant discourse is that as I was outlining these two concepts as representing very different discourse dynamics, I had expectations that they would be related to these two variables in different ways. Specifically in terms of disagreement, I didn't have a very strong expectation for justified opinion expression in either direction, especially for intolerant discourse. But for intolerant discourse and disagreement, I did. I expected that uncivil discourse would be positively associated with disagreement. And that is mainly because if people are exposed, you know, with opinions that they don't agree with, the conversations might become a bit more heated. If they become more heated, they might become a bit more uncivil and so on, right? But for intolerant discourse, I expected the exact opposite. One of the things that we know in early studies by, for instance, Madalena Wojcieszak and Diana Mutz had suggested that there are some pockets in the internet where people tend to find those more extreme opinions, and those environments tend to be characterized by a lot of homogeneity. So, you know, the echo chambers that we so talk about. It's not that echo chambers are everywhere, but there are echo chambers online, and in these places is typically where more extreme political views are voiced. If I recall, like this is a 2000 study or something like that, 2009 study. So I expected that intolerant discourse would actually surface when there's not a lot of disagreement, when people pretty much feel that everyone else kind of agrees with them on the topic they're talking about, right? And that was mainly the expectation because of the prior research suggesting that more extreme views, they tend to surface and then tend to be fostered by more homogeneous environments.
Yeah, definitely. This idea of disagreement and homogeneity, I think, is interesting. So overall, I think you have some findings that point to common trends, both on Facebook and the news websites where these stories were also present. And then you also find some differences between Facebook and these news sites. So what were some of the key findings that were common across both of these online spaces?
Yeah, so in this paper, I included the platform as a control variable, right, in the multivariate models. And what they suggested was kind of interesting and counterintuitive was that incivility was actually no more likely to prevail in news websites than on Facebook, which was interesting because it went in a different direction than the literature of incivility online would have been claiming so far, right? So I found that people are just as likely to be uncivil on Facebook with their real names and the pictures of their dogs and kids as they were on news websites. On the bivariate level, just looking at the sheer amount, I did find a bit more incivility on news websites than on Facebook, but when we control for everything else, including, you know, number of characters, those differences are no longer there. So the two platforms had more in common than I expected.
That's interesting that people, maybe they're, you know, there's just a general mode of being, you know, incivil on online platforms, but there were also some key differences between the two online spaces, right? So what were some of those differences and what do you think might explain them?
Yeah, so when we just compare like the sheer amount of incivility, there was a bit of a difference between Facebook and news websites. So without controlling for anything else, with news websites being a bit more uncivil, not immensely more uncivil than Facebook. But for intolerance, the difference was quite interesting because I actually found that news websites have very little intolerance. And even though intolerance is not a common behavior by any means, when it happened on Facebook. And to me, like the answer to that is moderation, right? Websites, news websites will typically systematically moderate comments that go to their page. They typically have you know, systems in place to do content moderation. There's a number of reasons why they do it, right? Like news websites are concerned that the quality and the content of comments can reflect badly on their own reputation, right? So there are many reasons and many incentives for moderation to take place. But on Facebook, there's no really systematic way of moderating content. And therefore, those things just go unchecked. In this research, I actually interviewed the social media managers for the two main sources that I had. So Portal UOL and Folha de São Paulo, because of the news website, I wanted to understand how moderation worked across different platforms. And the main thing that I learned from them was that on Facebook, you don't really have systematic forms of moderation. You can, you know, set lists with words that should be hidden. But other than that, there's really no way. And one of them even told me that they once asked Facebook, like, why can't we have like moderation tools? Moderation tools would be very helpful for us. And Facebook had told them at the time that, you know, people are using their real names. They should be accountable for what they say. So it's not your job to moderate it, which, you know, is fascinating if we think about the fact that this was 2016. But anyway, I think moderation is the explanation there. Like, they told me that, like, if they saw something really horrible as a comment under a news story that they posted on Facebook, they would remove it, but they wouldn't really go through like thousands and thousands of comments looking for things that are problematic in the same way that they would do for their own website, because it's Facebook. It's not almost like it's not their problem anymore. Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the point of moderation is so key, and a lot of studies don't get into it. But if we follow the literature and, you know, the arguments you make in your study, there would be an incentive for moderators to keep incivility, right? Because it attracts attention and can be kind of more engaging, but an incentive to remove intolerance, because that might make people leave the conversation.
Yeah, I think about these things less as an incentive to keep incivility than more of a, you know, the human judgment of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And to me, like, the kind of not proof, but proof that incivility is so context dependent and comes with a territory and is sometimes very bad and offensive, but it's at other times like completely harmless, is that even though websites in Brazil, news websites in Brazil tend to be, and the two main ones that I looked at were, very systematic and rigorous with their moderation practices, we still find like relatively high amounts of incivility when we look at the comments, but we find virtually no intolerance. So while incivility might be up for some discussion, is this uncivil, is this not uncivil, is this offensive, is this not offensive, it doesn't really seem like that's a problem with intolerance. It seems like when moderation see intolerant comments, they remove it right away. And I can talking with this, this interview part of my PhD research was really interesting, because in talking to them, one of the people that I interviewed, she was working on moderation for 20 years. She started with, like, you know, online forums, and she was now running this like huge operation for Portal UOL. And she was saying that it's really quite remarkable how creatively people will write really intolerant stuff. But in very polite ways, sometimes trying to be funny, sometimes trying to just, you know, be intolerant in disguise. Whereas, again, incivility, like the more blatant incivility, you know, profanities, vulgar words, and etc., pretty easy to catch with like relatively simple methods. So I found that quite rich, to say the least. But to me, the fact that, again, incivility can survive moderation, even when moderation is rigorous, suggests that it's not always a problem or seen as a problem, either by participants or by people who are rightfully so concerned that the tone and the quality of the comments on their stories can actually reflect on their own outlet, you know, reputation, perception of quality, and et cetera.
Yeah, totally. I think we probably see some differences in, you know, broadsheet comments and tabloid comments as well. But I wanted to ask you about the Brazilian context, because that's one of the interesting things about this study, given that Brazil is the, I think you write in the paper, the fifth most populous country, but there's comparatively little research on the online conversations there, even though there's a high level of social media adoption. So in looking at all of these online conversations in Brazil, do you think there's something particular to the Brazilian comments about how people engage in informal political talk, or is it roughly comparable to, say, the US or Europe?
That's an interesting question. And it's also always the question that you get when you study like anything other than the United States. Since this study, I've been looking at incivility and intolerance in the US, will soon be looking at this in the UK as well. So, you know, I've been been doing this kind of across countries as well. I wouldn't say that there are a lot of differences, at least in the types of instability that you find or even the amount, right? One thing that I think I mentioned in the study, and it's one of the most remarkable things that I see in the literature about instability in the past two decades, is that it doesn't really matter how you measure. It doesn't really matter what you consider to be uncivil. It almost doesn't really matter where you study instability. You almost always find roughly the same proportion. So most studies are going to range from 20-ish to 40-ish percent, although like mainly 30-something. Few studies have found less than that. So like basically, regardless of where you're looking, a third of what you're going to see is going to be uncivil. And again, regardless of how people measured incivility. So I don't think there's a lot of differences in whether, you know, Brazilians are more or less uncivil than others. I think what would be different if we were to look at incivility across different countries, and especially political incivility and political intolerance, would be the targets of that type of discourse. I think, for instance, if we think about differences between Brazil and the US, and I have another paper that looks at targets that discusses this a bit in detail. But one of the main targets of uncivil discourse are not like other people with whom you're discussing. In Brazil, it's typically like the political sphere. So people are talking about politics and politicians, they're just doing so in uncivil way. So let's say, you know, something like, you know, that person in Congress is a clown, or, you know, or a joke, or stupid, or etc. And I think in the US, politics is really, really personalized. So people tend to talk about specific politicians and less so about parties. And that's because it's a multi-party system with a ton of parties. Like, we have more than 30. And apart from five or so that most people could, you know, recognize, no one really thinks about or cares about party politics in Brazil. So you wouldn't have parties as targets, apart from basically two or three parties that are more widely discussed and talked about, right? A bit more prominent. Whereas in the United States, you will see not only specific politicians being targets of incivility, but also the party system, and other things that represent this very clear-cut bipartisan system that you have in the US. So I think the targets of discourse would change. And then if we think about Europe and different European countries and et cetera, we'll probably also see how incivility targets different groups or even different people. It is possible that in some countries that are more comfortable, really, with disagreement in politics, like, let's say, Israel, it is possible that people are a bit more uncivil towards each other, and that's okay because they don't really, you know, they might not even be withdrawn from the conversation if the conversation has a more heated tone. But I think that the main difference is targets, not really whether or not there is incivility and et cetera. Thinking about Europe, I think there would also be differences in just the sheer amount of social media use. I think Brazil is pretty comparable to the United States in terms of pretty heavy social media use, the types of platforms that are more prominent, with Facebook being the first one. Twitter is used at a similar rate as the US, and they are comparably active. So the online population in Brazil is comparably active to the online population in the US. We, of course, have some differences in Brazil in terms of just internet penetration. It's at roughly 70%, whereas in the US it's 90%. But I wouldn't expect that to make a very big difference in terms of who actually has access and who is participating in those discussions online.
Yeah, super interesting that more or less similar levels of incivility, no matter where you're looking or how it's measured.
I find it fascinating, to be honest, like this, just looking at how, you know, we have all this discussion about, oh, we need better measurements and we need to be able to, you know, measure the same things across studies, or even, you know, you have always to say there's a caveat that these people measure differently than I'm measuring. But in the end, like, I find it quite surprising and a little bit funny that it doesn't really matter how people have measured incivility. You just find just about the same. Also doesn't matter where they found incivility, where they were looking at, whether it was, you know, Usenet in the 90s or if it's Twitter today. And I just find that just fascinating.
Definitely. Super interesting. But You know, so far we've been talking all about political talk in terms of what citizens choose to write in their discussions online, kind of what they express and how they engage in discussion. But you can also share information, right, that you yourself didn't produce. And so I briefly want to get into another study you recently conducted on misinformation sharing across Facebook and WhatsApp, also in Brazil. And I think it's interesting because WhatsApp is this encrypted platform that we don't have so much research about. So can you describe first the motivations behind the study and how you went about studying WhatsApp?
Yeah, of course. That's a great question. There are, in fact, not a lot of studies about WhatsApp, but it's the few studies that we have are suggesting that, you know, in spite of being this encrypted platform where people are mostly talking to people they know, right, because you have to have the other person's phone, and people are talking mostly in small groups and et cetera, there's a whole lot of political discussion, political coordination, and even access to information going on there. I think in 2019, the Reuters digital news report showed that WhatsApp was used for news in Brazil at just about the same rate as Facebook. And that is just crazy because WhatsApp is not like, it doesn't have a news feed. It doesn't actually have the formal presence of the news media. There's just nothing there. It's chats, right? It's either individual chat or group chat. So it's quite interesting how political discussions start to happen there, but more than just political discussions, actually like this information sharing on WhatsApp. So part of the motivation behind that study, the study was supposed to be during the 2018 elections in Brazil, but it just wasn't because this is part of a research grant awarded by WhatsApp. The process for that grant, like just between application and announcement of the winners, just took way longer than we had expected. And by the time that we were selected, the elections were gone. By the time that we actually had funds, the elections were long gone. So we kind of shifted the topic from the elections a little bit. But explaining that this has to do with the elections is important because, as some people might know, because this was pretty broadly covered, the use of WhatsApp by parties and politicians in the 2018 elections in Brazil was quite intense. There has been scandals of misuse of WhatsApp using like bots and et cetera to disseminate political content and especially like disinforming political content. So like problematic political content. There has been several investigations about whether or not parties and candidates were involved in these types of practices. And WhatsApp was very much so involved in discussions of how to, you know, preserve the quality of information and et cetera. They banned or removed a bunch of accounts that were suspect of being engaging in like robotic behavior, so like bots and et cetera. So there was just a lot going on WhatsApp, but it is this still this texting platform that we have very little access. There's no API. Some people are studying these like big WhatsApp groups where, you know, you can have up to 254 people and there's a lot of sharing of information. But something that we kind of felt when we were designing this study, this application, was that, yes, these groups exist and like these parties and use also exist and et cetera. But this is probably not, you know, what the everyday person gets. This is probably not what most people experience when they're using WhatsApp. So instead of thinking too much about the content that circulates, what people are seeing, we decided to go with a survey to just see like how prevalent is this, right? Like how much do people actually use WhatsApp for talking about politics? Is it just that we are kind of weirdos and we talk about politics on WhatsApp with friends? Or is it a thing that everyone is doing as well? So the idea, like the way that we went about this was with a survey, really a nationally representative survey that we even used some phone interviews to complement the online panels, just because like WhatsApp is virtually installed in every mobile phone with access to the internet in Brazil. And we know that more than 90% of those who have access to the internet in Brazil have mobile access. So like everyone who is online is also on WhatsApp, basically. So we wanted to reach these people. But some people, as we also know, are not on online panels, right? If you go with an online panel, you're not going to find, you know, sometimes less educated, some groups, some regions, and et cetera. In Brazil, we have huge like regional differences. So we complemented the survey, the online survey, with some phone-based interviews so we could get some of those mobile-only users, because we felt it would be pretty important to like evenly represent all regions, education levels, and et cetera, to be able to study this in Brazil. Like otherwise, you know, you don't want to study just the Southeast. You don't want a survey of people who live in São Paulo. So we try to get a pretty good representative sample that covered that entire country.
Definitely. And, you know, I wanted to spend most of the episode talking about incivility and intolerance. So we'll just kind of run to the findings here. And you looked at the relationship between misinformation sharing and three main variables: the frequency of political talk, people's experience with cross-cutting exposure, and social corrections. And I'd like to start with social corrections, because I think this is, you know, a part that's left out of a lot of disinformation research. People analyze how many fake accounts there were and how many messages were sent, but they don't talk about the social corrections that followed afterwards. So what did you find out about social corrections on Facebook and WhatsApp?
I think the first thing is that they happen a lot. Like, I expected to find some corrections, like otherwise we wouldn't have this in a survey that was already awfully long and that we had to cut a lot. But the thing that to me was the most interesting and impressive was that they happen a lot. So, you know, a lot of studies just say how misinformation goes wild and how much people share. And we were kind of interested in knowing, well, okay, so people are sharing these things. They might not always be ill-intentioned, right? Like they might be sharing just because they think it's important, just because they don't know it's false, and et cetera. But we were wondering, like, are these people ever called out for what they share? And we found that they are by it, like, fair amount. In our sample, roughly 1 in 4 of the people using Facebook said that they had experienced a social correction, that is, that someone had called them out for something they shared. And on WhatsApp, that percentage is even higher, it's about 36%. When we asked about whether they saw other people being corrected, we had even higher percentages. We had roughly 41% for Facebook and 46% for WhatsApp. And we also asked whether they had corrected someone else, right? Whether they engaged in social corrections. And we also found like fair share of people saying that they had. On Facebook, just about a third, so 32%. And WhatsApp, 4 in 10, so 40%. Said that they had actually engaged in this type of behavior. There are a couple of reasons why we asked all these three. One, like first, we thought that not a lot of people would say that they experienced the social corrections. We thought that that this would be a question with that desirability bias. So we wanted to get at the witnessing question as well, because maybe people are not going to say that they've been corrected, but they're going to say that these things happen. And if what we want to know is whether these things happen, that might be good enough. And it was kind of surprising to see how not only people are willing to say, yep, that happened to me, but also they were saying, I've also done this and I've been calling other people out all the time. And I'm seeing other people doing that as well. The second thing that I think is interesting is that social corrections of all types, so witnessing, engaging, or experiencing them, were more likely to take place on WhatsApp versus Facebook. And I think the explanation to that, at least in my mind's pretty clear and simple. WhatsApp is more private space. You are mostly talking to people you know. It is just possible that people feel a bit more comfortable to call someone else out. And I would imagine that they can also do so in a kind of, you know, nice way, right? To say, hey, friend that I like very much, you shared this thing. Did you know it's not correct, right? Whereas on Facebook, where you are exposed and connected to people that are not necessarily a part of your social life and et cetera, these corrections can be a bit harsher. And they're also very public, right? So even if someone, if you're on WhatsApp and let's say your grandma, and I use my grandma because she does sometimes share some of this stuff, but she shares, let's say, something on a family group that is misinformation, then you can just say in a private chat, like, hey, grandma, that was incorrect. And then no one will know, right? Like it's not a visible process. And therefore, I just think people are more comfortable with it on WhatsApp. So the last thing that's interesting is how these social corrections are associated with sharing behaviors. And in the study, we looked at two types of sharing. So we asked people if they had shared something that was fake and false, but they didn't know at the time that they share. But we also asked them if they had shared something that they knew was false, but shared it anyway. And being corrected for sharing misinformation was strongly and positively related to both of these types. So people who are sharing things either without knowing it's false or knowing it's false are being corrected in interesting ways. And while I expected that being corrected would be related to, sharing misinformation without knowing it's false, because, you know, it might be how you found out it was false, I really wasn't expecting it to be related to what we call purposeful misinformation sharing, because I, again, like expecting the biases of respondents of saying like, oh, of course I don't do this, I would expect that they would just not say so. We also found that, you know, witnessing corrections was positively associated with sharing misinformation on Facebook, but not on WhatsApp, which was an interesting platform difference. But we didn't really find anything about performing social corrections and either type of sharing. So people who are more likely to call others out for, you know, sharing misinformation are no more likely to be also sharing disinformation as well.
Yeah, I love the nuancing social corrections and also getting at them across platforms, I think is super important. And the paper will be linked to in the show notes for those who want to follow up with the full paper. But you also found that the frequency of political talk and exposure to cross-cutting information were positively associated with misinformation sharing on both platforms. And that seems to confirm a broader pattern we're seeing in research, which relates to the idea of a paradox of participation and misinformation. So can you describe that paradox and how your findings speak to it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great question. And it's one that I like to say that when all things were good and we were positive about the world, we used to think about the ways that social media, internet are good for democracy and etc. And now we've been thinking about how all those things that led us to good forms of participation also have this dark side, right? So this idea of this participation paradox is that like the more people use the internet for things that we typically say are good for democracy, so talking about politics or being exposed to very diverse political views and etc., the more they're also likely to be engaging in these behaviors that are potentially dysfunctional. I think like the link between sharing misinformation and just being more active just has to do with like, you share a lot of things. Like if you're very active in talking about politics, if you're a very active information sharer online, then there is a good chance you might share things that are true and things that are false without knowing that they are false. So I think it's just this idea that like more active users, they're more active for both good reasons, but also potentially for bad reasons. And the same is true for these agreements. So like one of the things that we found that I thought was very striking was that cross-cutting exposure, so exposure to views that are different than yours, was really strongly associated with sharing misinformation on purpose. So sharing something that you know is false. So we found that people are roughly 50% more likely to share on both platforms misinformation knowing it's false if they are frequently exposed to cross-cutting views, which is pretty problematic because it means that, you know, the thing that political science has been saying it's great for democracy and it's actually a vital part of democratic societies, right? Being exposed to disagreement, respecting disagreement, understanding the other side, that's very much associated with a pretty problematic behavior that is sharing misinformation, knowing it's false on social media, right? So I think it's the paradox is kind of this. So the more you do something, the more likely you're also likely to do that thing for good and bad. So you talk a lot about politics, you might talk about politics and also share misinformation. You see a lot of cross-cutting exposure. That's great. But is it great if it leads you to share misinformation? Like, I think it's this view that all the things that we used to think of and see as just inherently good signs that the internet can have and social media can have, like good or desirable democratic outcomes, like increased participation, increased engagement with political talk or disagreement, they also lead to some of the behaviors that we now have been looking at and examining as pretty problematic and detrimental.
Definitely. And following up on this paradox, my last question for you has to kind of do with linking the two studies together, which is getting your thoughts on the relationship between justified opinion expression and misinformation. So if justified opinion expression conducted in an uncivil manner can have positive democratic effects because you're supporting your argument with evidence, what if these opinions are justified with misinformation? Is that sort of a inherently negative thing to justify an opinion with misinformation? Or could it be that the act of engaging in justified opinion expression, even with misinformation, might still be preferred over sort of not justifying your opinion or talking about politics at all?
That's a great question and also a very difficult one. And the answer is going to be very evasive because I think it just depends on context, right? The relevance of justified opinion, as I mentioned before, like from this deliberative point of view, is that when you allow others to understand why you think what you think, they can also engage with those reasons in a conversation, right? And that's particularly important for, heterogeneous discourse, right? So it is possible that people who support their views with wrong information without knowing it's wrong, so like, no, not on purpose, can be challenged by someone else with whom they are discussing and then learn those reasons were wrong. So as long as it's still open to discussion, as long as there is the possibility that their reasons are challenged, and there's also the possibility that they will accept when their reasons are challenged, it is not necessarily a bad thing. I think one of the things that not only my study, but others have also shown is that a lot of people share misinformation without knowing it's false. A lot of people share misinformation because they just feel it's urgent. I think like we used to talk a lot about misinformation, political misinformation and et cetera, but just thinking about like right now, we think about misinformation about the elections. You can't have the US elections pretty detrimental outcomes because it's still out there. It's still happening, right? When we think about misinformation about COVID, and I know you had Leticia here, Leticia Bode here a few episodes back, and her work is very focused on health misinformation. Like it's really detrimental because if someone is saying, drink Clorox and you're going to be free of the virus, you can die. But a lot of people share these things because they feel urgent, even if they don't know if it's true at the time. So I think I wouldn't say that supporting your views with misinformation is inherently problematic because I think it is possible that a lot of people do that without knowing that they are sharing something that's false. I don't know if I would go as far as saying that talking about politics based on misinformation is preferable over not talking at all. But I think, again, like it depends on context, right? I think if people who are using false information to justify their positions and are not accepting corrections or not accepting that their views are disputed, it's just possibly that they're just going to become more ill-informed. It's possible that they are going to trust institutions, the media, other people, politicians, science less, right? It's possible that they're just going to become enclaved in their own beliefs, which in turn would actually seem pretty problematic to me, right? If we think about, echo chambers where misinformation can run wild and it's either not challenged or the challenges are not accepted, then it's no longer misinformation, is it? It becomes almost a conspiratory view or conspiracy theories. And in that case, then they can have pretty detrimental and long-term consequences for society, particularly in undermining trust, right? Trust in other people, engaging with diverging views, and trust in media, science, institutions, and et cetera.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So many nuances to the comments that we come across all the time on platforms like Facebook or WhatsApp. So, Dr. Rossini, thanks so much for taking the time out and sharing your research with us.
Thanks for inviting me. That was fun.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Patricia Rossini, Derby Fellow in the Department of Communication and Media at the University of Liverpool. Be sure to check out the episode description for links to the two studies that we discussed in the episode. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. As we head into Thanksgiving after a major election, remember, it's okay to be incivil, but not intolerant, with your counterattitudinal relatives. I'm your host, Michael Pesetta, signing off from Melba. See you next time.